This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's really a great privilege to get to speak at a university of this stature, how wonderful it is. But it's a really special personal pleasure for me to be able to come and speak at a university that I could not have been admitted to. There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university, wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities. His words remain true today. Masefield wasn't referring to great cathedrals or ivied walls. To him, the splendid beauty of the university was because it was a place where those who hate ignorance can strive to make others know, and where those who perceive the truth may strive to make others see. So that's why I chose this place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds, and the truth is really too rarely perceived. Yet it's a topic of vital importance to every single one of us. American law, is it an instrument of progress or is it a weapon of repression? Now, by repression, I mean both physical and economic repression. And by American law, I mean not only the legislatures, but the civil justice system, where people, consumers, ordinary people, investors, sue for damages to hold perpetrators of fraud, discrimination, price fixing responsible, compensating the victims, and hopefully deterring similar harmful conduct by others. And the criminal justice system, that's where police and prosecutors hold violators of the law personally accountable. They punish perpetrators individually for their misconduct, hopefully deterring similar misconduct by the future. And, of course, I include the judges who oversee the system. Now, as our American legal system operates, it shapes the behavior of important actors throughout our society. It deters harmful conduct, or it encourages it, depending on the behavioral incentives the system's outcome create. American law came from England. There, the law operated to protect an aristocratic and ruling class. It was the king's deer that could not be poached. Rich property owners were protected. The courts enforced their contracts and their rights. An accused had no rights. Prosecutors tortured. Judges sat in star chambers. And you got hung for stealing a loaf of bread. English law, and it was English law that was so repressive that the American colonies rebelled. And they justified their rebellion to an inquiring world upon England's unjust laws, unjust judges, and unjust administration of justice. And in the new American legal system, it explicitly assured its system, its citizens, justice. It guaranteed them a jury trial in every civil lawsuit. It also guaranteed them protections from excessive bails, fines, unreasonable searches and seizures. And citizens were not to be deprived of their life or their liberty without due process of law. Well, whatever the hopes were for a more equal and just legal system, where they were stillborn. Under American law, certain humans were treated as slaves, pieces of property with no rights. And women had damn few rights. And for the next 150 years, American law served America's new elite, continuing to operate really as an instrument of physical and economic repression. To enforce this repression, the Supreme Court issued atrocious decisions. In Dred Scott, they affirmed that a black man was property with no rights. Plessy versus Ferguson upheld racial segregation in public schools and facilities. The Supreme Court of the United States sanctioned child labor, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. The court allowed Chinese children born here to be classified as colored and subject to racial segregation. The court upheld forced sterilization of dumb people. And the court even upheld the detention of United States citizens of Japanese ancestry in concentration camps in America without any due process. In fact, by the mid-20th century, American law allowed the police and the prosecutors to do just about whatever they wanted to do to just about anybody, just about anywhere. Even in modern New Deal times, American law did nothing to prevent or remedy the widespread lynchings and terrorizing of millions of our citizens across large parts of America by lawless mobs, often encouraged and always tolerated by the local police. So 150 years along the way, American law was falling well short of anything remotely resembling equal access, fair and equal treatment, or blind objective justice for all citizens. But with the great World War II, post-World War II boom, came thaw and an evolution in American law. In that war, blacks, other minorities, including Japanese Americans, fought heroically, albeit in segregated units. Women left home to work and to serve, all of this in the name of justice and equality against enemies which had persecuted and killed millions for their religion, their race, and their ethnicity. The divergence between the goals Americans had fought and died for and the reality of post-war American law was stark. And that's when things started to change. By the time I went to the law school, in the 1960s, American law was evolving rapidly. New lawsuit rules had been passed to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every civil lawsuit. And for the very first time, it allowed big class action damage suits against big corporations where one person, harmed by large-scale economic misconduct, could sue for all the victims and finally have a fair economic fight. During much of my life in the law, I witnessed how courageous advocates, using improved access to the courts, could achieve progress that just couldn't have been achieved otherwise. And there is no better example of that than Brown versus the Board of Education, a class action which desegregated public schools, progress that was made impossible politically because of Southern white power. One man, one vote, Baker versus Carr, was a class action which achieved that advance, stopping rural legislators from drawing districts based on acres, not people, making progress impossible to achieve politically. Then came Griswold and Roe versus Wade. It was private lawyers suing who overturned laws that were nothing more than the repressive exercise of religious dogma and allowed Americans to engage in family planning and control their reproduction. Again, progress, politics blocked. Individuals also started to hold corporations to account in suits. Product liability suits are just one example. When I was a kid, automobiles were death traps. Exploding gas tanks, stiff steering wheels, fragile glass. It was civil suits that exposed these defects. And this was what forced the auto industry to make crash-worthy, safer cars and led the government regulation of all products and their safety that saved countless lives over the years. As class actions took hold, securities fraud lawsuits, the kind of stuff that I specialized in, began to recover billions of dollars for investors cheated in the savings and loan fraud way. We exposed widespread criminal behavior in that industry. Later, class actions against the next wave of corporate fraudsters, Enron, Adelphia, WorldCom, and many others, recovered over $20 billion for cheated investors. Recoveries like this have never happened before. Nothing like it. Modesty aside, I was the lead counsel for the plaintiffs in the Enron case. Thank you, Lynn Schenck. Well, sort of. You know. I remember. These suits exposed vast illegal insider trading by executives. But we extracted the billions of dollars almost entirely from the big Wall Street banks that had schemed with these companies to inflate their profits and their stock prices. Antitrust class actions also thrived, exposed widespread illegal price fixing across the corporate universe, recovered billions and billions of dollars more from competitors turned conspirators. And many other successful class action suits recovered large amounts of money for victims of race and sex and age discrimination, again, almost always from major corporations, and again forced them to adopt progressive employment practices far beyond anything the government had achieved. By the 1990s, American law had evolved even to entertain class action lawsuits on behalf of victims of human rights abuses overseas, including the victims of the European Holocaust. Class actions filed 50 years after that singular human rights disaster sued big German corporations that profited from using slave labor to assist the Nazi industrial state. We also sued the Swiss banks that helped the Nazi state fence its so-called dental gold, and then after the war, stole thousands of so-called dormant numbered bank accounts and safe deposit boxes of Holocaust victims, refusing heirs access without death certificates, which the Nazis had not issued. These suits ultimately recovered $10 billion for these victims after all that those years, and helped further to expose the complicity of these big international corporations and banks in what was done in Europe. Then there was the tobacco industry. You know, it was private citizens enraged at this oligopoly of death that filed the suits that ended the infamous Joe Camel, which had enticed our young Americans to begin smoking. These tobacco suits exposed secret documents showing how craven executives aggressively marketed products as addictive as heroin, targeting our nation's children and causing incalculable illness and suffering. Cost the industry $250 billion, but also, and this is really what's important, we forced them to agree to the first real restrictions on the marketing of their deadly products that ever occurred, and there you see the results of it. Remember, thank you. This evil industry's power had long prevented government action, but it could not stop empowered citizens fighting in open courthouses to redress wrongs, and it forced benefits for our entire society. Now, as the American civil justice system opened up over these years, the criminal system progressed very much as well. When this SNL and insider trading fraud wave exploded in the 80s, hundreds of executives at Savings and Loans and in Wall Street banks were indicted and imprisoned. Falsified corporate accounting, accompanied by massive illegal trading, was widespread, but it was no joke when generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP, was turned into cleverly rigged accounting ploys. And that's crap. With Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, and other frauds, a number of top executives were again indicted, prosecuted, and were put in jail. Also convicted was the huge accounting firm Arthur Andersen, which had schemed with Enron to falsify its finances. By the 1980s and 1990s, never, ever had so much money been recovered by class actions for so many victims of so much corporate misconduct, or so many corporate executives been held personally accountable and individually prosecuted for their crimes. Courageous lawyers also advanced the long-violated rights of our least influential citizens. They overturned precedents that had allowed police searches and arrests without warrants or on the flimsiest grounds. And in so doing, they exposed widespread prosecutorial misconduct, like using perjured testimony and hiding exculpatory evidence. Decisions like Mapp, Miranda, and Gideon, and Brady were landmarks of progressive American justice. Lawyers sticking up for improperly searched individuals who'd been coercively interrogated, denied a lawyer, convicted by dishonest prosecutors, they obtained rulings that finally gave real meaning to the core constitutional guarantees. And you know it was lawyers representing the unpopular and the impoverished who finally marshaled such evidence of the disgraceful, discriminatory application of the death penalty that the Supreme Court was forced to suspend it. Well, during this post-World War II, I love this visual. This is my street. During the post-World War II thaw of the American legal system I've just been describing, throughout the 1990s, you know, America really enjoyed what many economists have said was a golden era. There's no question it was the strongest sustained economic growth our nation has ever had, with the highest real wage growth ever. More wealth created with more widespread distribution of that wealth than ever. And you know what? By the 1990s, most American workers were covered by public or private pension plans that were fully funded, and they anticipated secure retirements. During this time period, upward mobility in America really opened up. And my wife and I are two examples of it. She's the daughter of a military family. I came from a family of hand-me-down clothes and used cars. But due to upward mobility, due to opportunity, and teachers, and scholarships, and mentors, we succeeded. And so did millions other of Americans during our generation for the very same reason. And at the very same time that American law was finally operating as an instrument of progress in our society. Now, I want to address some changes in American law which alarm me. As I've said, for most of its history, Anglo-American law has been an instrument of the rich and the powerful in the state, operating as a weapon of economic and physical repression. And before our very eyes, but before us really realizing it, American law is being transmogrified right back into that weapon of repression, and it's having very adverse consequences for all of us. Frederick Douglass said, "Power concedes nothing without a struggle." And corporate executives and Wall Street bankers were furious about the criminal prosecutions and class actions that were exposing their frauds, their insider trading, price fixing, discrimination, human rights abuses, and the like, actually putting executives in jail while forcing their companies to pay billions of dollars in compensation to the victims. And as I've pointed out, even restricting their most aggressive and abusive business practices. So, at the behest of the Wall Street Corporate Alliance, the political process responded with legislation, rule changes, judicial appointments, all as part of a coordinated, very well-funded campaign to restrict the ability of prosecutors to prosecute corporate executives and private citizens to bring class action lawsuits. For instance, the very key laws that had been used by investors and others to recover billions from corporate miscreants, as I just described, were gutted by Congress in 1995 and 1998, while other laws that had restricted Wall Street speculation and protected investors, ordinary people, were gutted as well. The judicial system also responded as desired. It sharply curtailed several criminal laws that apply to corporate executives. Courts reversed all but one of the Enron executives' criminal convictions, this in the corporate crime of the century. And the courts reversed several other important convictions, sharply curtailing the reach of the criminal laws as applied to executives. Now, insider stock trading by corporate executives has been a felony since 1934. Corporate executives give themselves large amounts of stock options. They also control the corporate information, and they control the disclosures. This gives them the opportunity to illegally sell off stock in front of bad news, insider trade for profit, pocketing millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. As the corporate criminal laws were rolled back, being eviscerated, executives became so brazen as to begin to secretly backdate their stock options to even lower prices to increase their personal illegal profits. That's stealing. This became a national scandal. It's a dirty insider corporate secret by which the executive class enriches itself. Yet virtually every one of these backdating convictions were reversed by the courts. Courts also reversed other insider trading convictions, gutting these criminal laws. And so, It's no surprise that ongoing insider trading by corporate executives in America nets them billions of dollars every year. This is nothing more than a wealth transfer from ordinary stock market investors to corporate insiders. Now, with respect to other civil suits like we used to bring, the Supreme Court has become an active combatant on the corporate side. The Chamber of Commerce writes the friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs, and the court simply adopts them as American law. Issue after issue, punitive damages, class action, securities, civil rights, discrimination, antitrust. It's so consistent, it's suggestive maybe of a stacked deck. You know, after the WorldCom and Enron cases recovered billions of dollars from these corrupt Wall Street banks, the court just marched in to their rescue, ruling now that even if a third party like a bank knowingly schemes with a company to falsify its profits, inflate its stock price, and cheat its investors, just like Enron and WorldCom, they cannot be sued in a class action. That's American law today. We recovered $7.3 billion on an invalid legal theory. And that was a pretty good theory. This closed the courthouse doors to victims of the worst kind of securities fraud, where the company goes bankrupt and there's no one else to recover from but the banks. You'll never see a more value-laden, Wall Street-friendly anti-investor ruling. As part of the campaign to close the courthouse doors to victims of corporate illegality, the court has now eliminated the ability to bring the human rights cases against big international companies like our Holocaust cases, even if the victim now lives in the United States and the defendant corporation has big operations here. This is all part of an ongoing effort by the court to cripple, really kill class actions, regardless of their subject matter. The court's hostility to class actions now extends across the board, civil rights, prisoners' rights, similar type class action litigations. The court has handed victory after victory to these big corporations, and it now relegates American consumers, investors, victims of every kind of corporate abuse, to individual arbitration. The Supreme Court of the United States has very quietly and effectively now just about wiped out consumer, antitrust, employment discrimination type class actions, enforcing these mandatory arbitration waivers, waiving your jury trial rights, waiving your class action rights, buried in the fine print of these contracts. And now with the internet, every one of you, every one of us, every single day gives up our jury trial rights and our class action rights just to get to the next damn page on the computer without reading it. Class actions are down 50% in the last few years. You don't need to know more. Well, what happened as the courts started to cut back on these criminal laws and access to the courts? Well, as they took hold, our nation quickly found itself awash in one set of frauds after another. First, 2002, huge high-tech telecommunications meltdown. Investors in pension funds lost $5 trillion in that fiasco. Then just a few years later, in 07 and 08, amid continuing feasts of cookbooks, the financial giants imploded. The worst collapse since the 20s. It nearly destroyed our economy, created the worst economic downturn in our lives, and inflicted $15 trillion of losses on pension funds and investors. Now, look, the extent of this 07-08 Wall Street wrongdoing is almost incomprehensible. Every single major bank was implicated. the big banks ended up paying over $250 billion in criminal fines. Goldman Sachs just paid another $5 billion last week. You know, go to the next slide. This cover is from 2002. How long have we been asking this question? And the answer is more than you ever knew. That 07-08 fraud thing was just the tip of an iceberg. The banks were involved in a much more widespread pattern of criminal conduct. Several big banks were caught assisting massive tax evasion schemes by the top American financial elite. They pleaded guilty to criminal violations and paid billions of dollars in fines. Next, many big banks were also caught assisting terrorists, rogue nations, and drug dealers, laundering illegally billions of dollars for them, criminal fines of billions of dollars paid again by many of the same banks. The big banks were then also caught in the largest criminal price fix in history, a pervasive, epic daily fix of the worldwide interest rate, impacting trillions of dollars of loans. Millions and millions of borrowers all over the world were cheated by these illegally fixed interest rates. Again, several big banks pleaded guilty to criminal violations and paid billions more in fines. And then the same banks were caught in an even bigger price-fixing conspiracy, if that seems possible, fixing foreign exchange rates, the backbone of trillions of dollars of daily commerce. The banks were skimming every single day, cheating all over the world. And again, they got caught, they pled guilty, and paid billions of dollars in criminal fines. So, not to put too fine a point on it, the biggest banks in the United States were at the same time engaged in the largest frauds in their own finances since the 1920s, while fixing worldwide foreign exchange rates and worldwide benchmark interest rates, while laundering money for terrorists and drug dealers, while helping the super rich in the U.S. evade their taxes. Criminal violations, one and all, and by recidivists at that. Not for nothing do they call them banksters. A term that was first invented for these guys, you know, in 1929, when they destroyed the world's stock markets and economies. They also destroyed the lives of an entire generation of Americans, just like they've done again, by the way. But you know, it's just not the banks. This criminality spreads across the entire corporate universe. Bribery. Bribery is a big-time crime in the United States, and corporations are big-time in it, violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Many of the very largest, well-known, supposedly respectable corporations have been caught paying bribes. And again, billions of dollars in criminal fines paid. Look at the huge, respectable international drug companies. Every one of them run by highly educated grads from the elite business schools of the world, and they've constantly illegally marketed their drugs for unapproved uses, endangering lives, and cheated Medicare and Medicaid by overcharging taxpayers to pad the corporate profits in their personal take. And they've paid $12 billion in criminal fines. Oh, here's another one. The automobile industry, the backbone of our nation for so many years, has repeatedly violated U.S. safety and environmental laws. Airbags, ignitions, accelerators, hundreds of deaths. It's a rogue industry, with a culture of criminal behavior. The Volkswagen scandal is only the most recent. And again, we see criminal violations, criminal fines. But now stop for a minute and note something. Here, and in every one of these instances of criminality I have just shown you and discussed ad nauseum, the individual executives who committed the crimes walked away unscathed. No executives have even been indicted, much less one convicted, despite the admitted criminality of the conduct of the corporations which they were running. Now look, the public was promised that the executives and the other corporations at the big banks and other corporations would be held individually responsible for this conduct. Equal justice and a functioning criminal system demand as much. It's no secret that criminal conduct was involved in this fake accounting and massive insider selling. This commission finds so. And remember, in all of these cases, the corporations had already admitted to criminal conduct. That commission asked for criminal cases. None happened. 25 years before, as I said, hundreds of SNL executives were prosecuted. This time, despite a clear pattern of rampant criminal misconduct by these top financial operators, which justified the payment of billions of dollars in criminal fines and repeated guilty pleas, every one of them got off. Geez, even Little Iceland could put 26 of their bankers in jail. American law, after the worst financial crisis and bank crime wave in over 70 years, after all this crime, not one executive was prosecuted. You know, there was this big strike force they were going to have. Where are they now? These guys come and go. Came from Pepsi-Cola, went back to Pepsi-Cola. Came from King & Spalding, went back to King. Didn't do anything other than get a lot of headlines when they were put together. Now, watch this. The top Justice Department officials who orchestrated all of this. Eric Holder, the Attorney General, Holder's top personal assistant, and the head of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, are all now back with the same corporate law firm in D.C. from whence they came. It's just four blocks down the street from the DOJ. They now resume making millions of dollars a year at their old firm that then, and while they were in office and now, represents many of the very banks and corporations that I have mentioned here tonight in this widespread criminal conduct. The firm even kept their corner offices vacant, waiting for them. These guys didn't even have to change their parking garage. Now, all these bank criminal guilty pleas really don't mean a thing. In terms of punishment or deterrence, first of all, these pleas have no business consequences. It's business as usual. Look at this. You know, an assurance in advance from the government that your guilty plea to criminal conduct in your business operations will have no adverse impact on your business operations is quite unusual. And even these shocking boxcar fines that I've said, 100 billion, whatever they are, they're an illusion. Listen, the banks got the money to pay these fines from the government in the bailout money. And the banks also get to go to the Fed window and borrow for zero, arbitrage it into long-term government bonds at 3%, and mindlessly and risklessly make the money to pay the fine. This was an economic charade and a shell game that gave an illusion of enforcement when there really wasn't any. None of the money to pay these fines or penalties came from the corporate executives, not a single penny. The executives used the corporate till, the shareholders' money, to pay these fines to protect themselves while they keep their salaries, bonuses, and insider stock proceeds. The actual criminal actors, the actual perpetrators, pay nothing, and they keep everything. Our antitrust laws, which we enacted 100 years ago to stop the very kind of concentration of economic power that we now see going on with mega merger after mega merger, the Supreme Court has gutted them. And now the court has even empowered these ever larger earthships to spend unlimited amounts of money on the political process. The sad truth is American law has created a corporate kleptocracy. A group of executives who run these behemoths are a stateless elite, a privileged caste, immune to the sanctions of American civil or criminal law. So much for equal access or equal justice in the economic arena. Okay. Economic repression is one thing. Physical repression is another altogether. American minorities know that they are being targeted by the police, even though the police are less likely to find contraband on them. And unfortunately, too many of these encounters go bad, at least for those stopped, for a burnt-out taillight and not using a turn signal. Police violence has been going on forever, and it's not been accurately reported. With smartphones, body dash cameras, more and more, this brutality is visible to us all. And while it seems shocking to us whites, and I want to say I'm disappointed about something tonight. I wish there were a lot more black faces in this audience. I really do. But anyway, you know, this is visible to us all now. You know, it's shocking to us. It's not the black people. Harvard calls it an epidemic. It's not. No more than Bob Dylan needed a weatherman do African Americans need videos to know how abusively violent the police have been to them. This has been part of their lives forever. Well, here's the question. Violent crime is down, and yet police seem to be killing everywhere. A guy selling loose cigarettes is choked to death. A boy playing with a toy gun in a park near his house. A guy running away from a traffic stop, shot in the back. A young man walking away from the cops takes 16 bullets. Kid thrown in a police truck with a broken back dies. A six-year-old killed when cops filled his dad's stopped car with gunfire. And a handcuffed guy tasered 20 times outside of an emergency room and killed. It's shocking that America doesn't even have a national registry of police killings. It's at least 1,000 a year. 50% of the time, victim is unarmed. At least 33% of the time, pose no immediate threat. 20% of the time, the police planted or altered evidence to try to protect themselves. Washington Post says 10,000 killings in 10 years, 11 convictions. New York City, one conviction in 179. Look, the level of police violence here is inconceivable in any other nation. What happens to the police or kill without justification? Basically, nothing. They're never held to account by internal review systems. The code of silence protects them. Institutional bias makes that more of an insult than a remedy. Do you remember Tamir Rice, 12-year-old kid in Cleveland? Dispatcher is told, look at the email at the top. I'm not going to read it. I won't read it. 12-year-old boy in a park. Cops were told he's a kid. Gun's probably fake. Kill him in 2 seconds. Local DA used the grand jury to clear the police there. He let the police come in and read a statement, and they weren't asked any questions. You know, the shooter cop had failed firearms and another police and department had been fired. Not only did the abusive police never face criminal charges, the Supreme Court won't let them be held individually liable. Did you see the new decision on this? Texas police chase. Texas policeman told to stand down. Goes to the overpass. Even though there are nails in the road, they're going to stop him. Fires 6 bullets into the car. Kills the guy. Direct disobedience of his order. Says to the boss, how's that for initiative when he sees him? Supreme Court said can't sue him. Have to resolve all doubts in favor of the police. Can't be held liable unless it's unreasonable beyond doubt. Now, police killings and physical abuse without consequence are not all. Here are some ugly truths. Police too frequently use their power to abuse people sexually. People too frequently plant evidence to convict or alter it to protect themselves. Police too frequently lie in court. The misconduct is widespread, and it's acknowledged. Prosecutors too frequently compound these abuses. Prosecutors too frequently conceal exculpatory evidence. You know, this is a long tradition of prosecutors. Do you know in the Japanese internment case, there was a report in the possession of the Naval Intelligence Department that said that the police, that the Japanese posed no threat whatsoever, and they concealed it. Prosecutors use flawed expert testimony. And here's something that's horrible. Our key constitutional protection against unreasonable bail has been gutted. It's being abused, and it's especially oppressive on minorities. A $5,000 bond for no reason ruins a person. They can't get out to go to work. The girl in Missouri, Sandra Bland, stopped for a traffic violation, put in jail, couldn't put up a tiny bond, ends up dead. I'll tell you what's going on. It's a bail racket, and the local magistrates and judges are imposing these bails in return for political contributions and God knows what else. In many states, large fines are imposed for minor offenses, and it's really just a way to enhance revenue in small towns. It's really a form of special tax on minorities. The system is so repressive. From arrest to detention, the problem is so widespread that the Justice Department has about 20 police departments under investigation. We've become a prison nation. 2.3 million people in jail. 2.3 million, more than any place in the world, with horrible consequences, you know, with few exceptions. And I happen to be one of them. A criminal conviction and a time in jail ruin your life. Even an arrest that you can't bail yourself out on costs you your job. We have a record number of people serving life in this country at an annual cost that far exceeds college tuition and a lot of good schools. You know, as part of the crackdown, the death penalty was put back in business in the South. And it really became a death factory, at least for blacks who kill whites. This despite the continuing evidence of unfairness and discrimination and the conviction of innocence. Public opinion demands that the police and prosecutors solve and convict in every capital case. And what needs be done will be done many times. And the innocent be damned. Far too many, these are your fellow citizens, have spent years in jail. New scientific evidence has proved time and again that we've convicted lots of innocent people, not a few, lots. And remember, we only get to read about the big capital case where some poor schmo gets saved because of the Innocence Project or some other. Think about all the people that nobody cares about and nobody is going to help. Who pays for this? Not the individual police. Not the individual prosecutor. Don't pay a penny. No more than any of the dishonest corporate executives pay. You pay. We pay. The taxpayers pay. Look at the size of these ridiculous payments that are being imposed because of police misconduct. How many college educations and preschools does that pay for? And that, I think, is the heart of the matter, you know? American law protects bad police, dishonest prosecutors, just like it protects dishonest bankers and lawless corporate executives, all but completely insulating these people from any personal consequences, criminal or civil, for their conduct. And you know what? None of them has any incentive to change the way they behave. And as a result, American law is operating as an instrument of repression. The American legal system is not the best legal system in the world. It ranks 65th in civil justice and 26th in criminal justice. Those rankings should make every one of us humble. What about the judges? Where are the highly educated, independent overseers of this American legal system? Look, I realize the Supreme Court's a political entity on an ideological pro-corporate, pro-police agenda. Fine. But what about the day-to-day judges down in the system? The guys who work in the bus station. The only judges most people will ever come in contact with in their life. Well, these are the judges that see the cops lie and tolerate it. These are the judges that impose punitive bails or fines which equate to a jail sentence which poor people can't pay. And some of these judges have presided over every one of these trials where an innocent person has been convicted and some have been sentenced to death. In most parts of the United States, local judges are prosecutors of the local prosecutor's office, and they're elected in a political process where the local police and the police unions are dominant. Even in the federal system, which is much more elevated and better, many of the judges come from a prosecutorial background. Look, I know there are so many judges and police who do their jobs properly and admirably. I add, they sought these jobs voluntarily, and the jobs provide them with power and prestige and good pay and great pensions. But their good work simply can't excuse or justify the bad conduct of the others. Unfortunately, the good, decent people who are doing their jobs are in a system poisoned by others who've managed to create a horrible toxic mix with adverse consequences for the rest of us. And let me quickly run through them. Compared to that golden age of opportunity and growth I described for you, as American law has been rolled back and the system constricted and closed, look what's happened. Here's one concrete example. The tremendous losses in our fraud-infested financial markets have gravely injured the American public and private pension system, leaving them unfunded today by many, many trillions of dollars. While corporate executives were enriched and the banks gorged on big fees, the retirement securities of millions of Americans has been endangered. Take the late retirement and early death option. It's a multi-billion dollar crisis, and it's looming for all of us because in the end, taxpayers are going to pay for it. People see the upsurge in corporate corruption. They see there's no equality to access of civil justice, and it creates disrespect for the system, which now ranks 66. America's courthouse doors are now just about closed to ordinary citizens. We just don't have any effective way of taking on these powerful actors. Now, you know, if the closure of this legal system and the immunity for these corporate executives was supposed to usher in some era of great economic prosperity and growth and increased competitiveness, boy, I missed it. I'll tell you what we do see is an acceleration of the concentration of wealth at the top. And worse, and look at this, worse, for the first time ever in America, upward mobility is disappearing. And we're falling behind other nations. This next chart is too much to look for a chart, and I shouldn't have done it, but I'll tell you what it shows. And this is the key, man. Before these crises started and our financial markets were destroyed, U.S. GDP growth was an average of 9%. After the S&L crisis, I think it fell to about 6%, and after the telecommunications and other crisis that occurred in 08, it's down to 4%. It's actually under 4%. Do you realize the guts have been ripped out of the American economy? And this is one of the really fundamental problems. Now, I don't say there's legal causation necessarily between what I've complained about and these events, but I'll tell you one thing that's true. There's temporal proximity, and it looks pretty good to me. Real wage growth for ordinary people in America is gone. Economic gains are going to the top. Not only have the long-promised pensions been impaired, but half of all Americans today make less than $30,000 a year and have zero savings. But what's really terrible, witness the poisoned relations between the law enforcement community and the minority communities. Empathy is the ability to see things from another person's point of view. Minorities see authoritarian, militarized, brutal police, dishonest prosecutors, and indifferent, if not hostile, judges. Their perceptions are not irrational. The divergence between no corporate executives being indicted, let alone convicted, compared to what happens to ordinary people at the other end of the spectrum is a disgrace. There is no equality of enforcement of the criminal laws in the United States. And we're now left with a large underclass, furious at the legal system, encountering increasingly armed, aggressive police forces and a repressive criminal justice system, and it's a vicious cycle. The repression creates resistance, which creates more repression, you know? Those were the conditions that produced the American Revolution a couple of hundred years ago, and they've produced a lot of other revolutions since then. If you ask me, I think Lady Justice's blindfold covers tears. Now, I know there are differences of opinion on these issues, and progress for some is decay to others. Repression for some is order to others. But as Masefield wrote, the hallmark of a great university is to debate these issues. And that's why I came here tonight and raised them, and I thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.